Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, May 29th. I arrived in New Orleans on Monday afternoon for a quick trip to see the National World War II Museum and get some sense of what is happening along the coast with the BP drilling disaster. And, of course, I sought to act as a one-man economic stimulus program for Bourbon Street, where I was staying for 3 nights, and I managed to accomplish virtually everything I set out to do. My first task upon arriving at the hotel was to ask the barmaid if she knew of anyone that would want to earn some major cash to take me on a little trip down to Grand Isle on Wednesday, and she asked Ryan, the bellman on duty when I checked in. Ryan had Wednesday off, and when I mentioned what I would pay him, he said, "I can do that." So short of my ride for Wednesday, on Tuesday I went to the WW2 Museum. Now, I'd been here just 2 weeks or 2 years earlier, but knew they made quite a few changes since then, including introduction of what proved to be a spectacular film, Beyond All Boundaries. And I could come here every 2 years the rest of my life and always pick up something new or have a principle or two reinforced. Do yourself a favor, bring the family down to this place. Your kids will thank you. Of course, then lock the kids in their room at night while you go out and have a good time. But here was one takeaway that pertains to today. After the first big carrier conflict of the war in May 1942, the Battle of the Coral Sea, which was essentially a draw, Admiral Nimitz sprang his trap at Midway. But Nimitz needed the USS Yorktown, heavily damaged in the Coral Sea, and was told it would require 3 months to repair. Nimitz said, "Get it done in 3 days." It was, though hundreds of engineers were aboard, putting on finishing touches as the Yorktown streamed to Midway, where the United States dealt the Japanese a crushing defeat that began to turn the tide in our favor. We got things done back then. Not always the first time, but few can argue with the results. Today, I don't really need to answer that, do I? Almost 9 years after 9/11, forget Bin Laden, we can't even find one-eyed Mullah Omar. 9 years later, we don't even have a suitable memorial at Ground Zero. It's pitiful. Well, on Wednesday I hopped in Ryan's beaten-up car for the long ride from New Orleans to Grand Isle. I'd never been to the Louisiana coast, though spent time post-Katrina in the Biloxi area across the way. And I have to admit, I had no concept of the distance, but Grand Isle was a good 2.25-hour drive, a boring one, until you got close to Grand Isle and the coastal waterways. Luckily, the talk shows were interesting, including Garland Robinette's, the fellow some of you have seen on the national newscast the past few weeks. As we approach Grand Isle, the narrow road is surrounded by marshland with nothing on the horizon but sky, and you really get a sense of the fragility of it all. And as we cross the causeway connecting the island to the rest of Louisiana, there they were, the booms, and looked at Ryan and said, "Those aren't holding anything back." The water, unlike what you saw on Obama's trip to Grand Isle on Friday, which was perfectly calm, was lapping over the booms, and of course we've all learned that the oil is going underneath as well. It was also at this time Ryan and I saw a potential problem on the horizon, very dark clouds, as in I said to him, "Our timing sucks, my man." So we're driving down the main drag with the signs that all the beaches are closed, and I'm taking in the fact that most of the homes are built on stilts that would have made Jack of Beanstalk fame proud. But it was getting darker, lightning was flashing in the distance, and I told Ryan to pull over as I ran up the sand dune to peer down the beach. Knowing full well I wouldn't have time to get to the ocean, the beaches were closed, but at this particular entrance no one was there to stop me, when the storm hit in force and I hightailed it back to the car. I swear in 5 minutes the main road there was flooding. The place is so flat. Forget hurricanes, you need a house 20 feet in the air just to prevent water damage from thunderstorms. So we went to the restaurant I had noticed on the way in, and as it was about noon all the workers were eating there, some not bothering to take off their life jackets. These were the guys laying the boom. I ended up seeing a number of staging grounds and lots of National Guard troops and heavy vehicles, so work is getting done, but a lot of it will be ineffective should any of the main plumes and patches of oil actually invade the area, as has been the case on a somewhat limited basis thus far, as this slow-motion disaster continues to unfold. Grand Isle had a fair amount of oil on the beach just a week ago, but this slick stayed offshore the past few days, which was why the pictures for Obama weren't any different than what you see at the Jersey Shore, only there the president would have been picking up medical waste. No, I didn't actually see the spill, nor, thankfully, pelicans covered in oil. but I was glad I took the trip down there, and I repeat, it's amazing how fragile the marshlands are. It's also easy for the rest of us to say, well, why would you live in a place like this where, forget oil, one storm with a surge of 10 feet would go miles inland because there's essentially nothing to stop the water? Because it's home. It's not more complicated than that. This isn't a case of, say, vacation houses along the New Jersey or North Carolina coast where you have little sympathy if they are destroyed in a storm. True, Grand Isle has some of that as well, but there is a long-standing community here, as there are others just a few miles inland. If your livelihood is fishing, there is no better place to be. And if you make your living working the rigs offshore, you want to live close by as well. Many of the people do both jobs. But for the record, let me dispense with some facts before sharing further opinion. The Deepwater Horizon timeline was April 20 explosion, April 22nd rig sinks, April 24 first oil leak detected, though no one can say definitively whether it started April 20th or any time in between. The Gulf Coast is responsible for 73% of the nation's domestically produced shrimp and 59% of its oysters. The restaurants I went to were not running out of either, almost 40 days after the spill, but shortages are coming soon. In Louisiana alone, an analysis of the commercial fishing licenses leads one to believe there are about 30,000 who attempt to earn a living on the water, and of course many times that in other industries, including the restaurant business. BP has offered to pay each fisherman $5,000 a month in compensation, but is dallying on handing out checks. You can also imagine that not everyone's motives are pure. There are men receiving checks who haven't fished in years, yet are working on the new prevention teams designed for the real fishermen. Before it was announced on Thursday and Friday that the estimate of the amount of oil that has been leaking was not BP's initial 5,000 barrels per day, but rather 12,000 to 19,000, and maybe up to 25,000, I saw others taking it to 30,000 to 40,000. With all the reading I've done on the topic, I think it's the latter. The spill exceeds that of the 1989 Exxon Valdez disaster. There is little doubt that BP was grossly negligent. Witness the argument taking place between senior managers of Transocean and BP just 11 hours before the well blew because of shortcuts BP was taking by replacing heavy drilling fluid with salt water, which no doubt played a significant role in the accident. BP's liability is now estimated by Wall Street analysts at anywhere from $12 billion to $20 billion. I'm in the camp that the disaster represents an existential threat to the company itself. It's also important to remember that Halliburton was responsible for the cementing of the well, Transocean was the maker of the rig, and Cameron International made the failed blowout preventer. Deepwater Gulf activity until the accident was expected to account for 30% of total U.S. oil production by 2013. Now, President Obama suspended planned exploration along the coast of Alaska and Virginia, as well as 33 wells underway in the Gulf, along with a moratorium on issuing new permits. In a Gallup survey, 53% believe Obama is doing a poor or very bad job of responding to the mess. Democratic strategist and longtime Louisiana native James Carville said, "Why do we still not know how much oil has been pumped out? Why did it take us 30 days to get the pictures? Who's running this show?" Presidential historian Douglas Brinkley said, "There's no sense President Obama has taken charge." As of a week ago, 600,000 gallons of the chemical dispersant Corexit had been sprayed on the water, with another 55,000 gallons down at the source of the blowout. BP was told by the EPA to come up with an alternative, but BP said there is no alternative in sufficient quantities. The government has never done a study of the impact of Corexit used at such levels. We are totally flying blind. Between the oil and the dispersant, while eventually nature would break down much of the oil on the surface, once it reaches the marshes, it poisons the plants, and with the plants poisoned, you eventually destroy the roots, and with nothing to anchor the ground, the first big hurricane rushing in is up against little more than sand. Maybe it's 10 or 20 years from now, but with a dead marsh, in theory, the water could rush in for miles and miles. Frank Pope of the London Times was evidently the first to go out in the spill last weekend and dive into it. He reported, 18 miles out and the stink of oil is everywhere. Rashes of red-brown sludge are smeared across vast swaths. Between them, a swell rendered faintly psychedelic with rainbow-colored swirls. Wreathed in neoprene and with Vaseline coating the exposed skin around our faces, we slip into the clear water in the lee of the boat. Beneath the mats of radioactive-looking, excrement-colored sludge are smaller gobs of congealed oil. Taking a cautious, shallow breath through my snorkel, I head downwards. 12 meters under, the specks of sludge are smaller, but they are still everywhere. Among the specks are those of a different hue. These are wisps of drifting plankton, the eggs and larvae of fish, and the microscopic plants and animals that form the base of almost all marine food webs. Any plankton-eating fish would now have trouble distinguishing food from poison, let alone the larger filter feeders. Onshore, small landfalls of the same sludge have started to cause panic among locals as they coat the marshes. Here, just a few feet beneath the surface, a much bigger disaster is unfolding in slow motion. "This is terrible, just terrible," says Dr. Susan Shaw of the Marine Environmental Research Institute. "The situation in the water column is horrible all the way down. Combined with the dispersants, the toxic effects of the oil will be far worse for sea life. It's death in the ocean from the top to the bottom." What worries Dr. Shaw most is the long-term potential for toxic chemicals to build up in the food chain. "There are hundreds of organic compounds in oil, including toxic solvents and PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, that can cause cancer in animals and people. In this respect, light sweet crude is more toxic than the heavy stuff. It's not only the acute effects, the loss of whole niches in the food web, it's also the problems we will see with future generations, especially in top predators." Peggy Noonan, Wall Street Journal. "I don't see how the president's position and popularity can survive the oil spill. This is his third political disaster in his first 18 months in office, and they were all, as they say, unforced errors, meaning they were shaped by the president's political judgment and instincts. The president, in my view, continues to govern in a way that suggests he is chronically detached from the central and immediate concerns of his countrymen. This is a terrible thing to see in a political figure, and a startling thing in one who's won so handily and shrewdly in 2008. But he has not, almost from the day he was inaugurated, been in sync with the center. The heart of the country is thinking each day about A, B, and C, and he is thinking about X, Y, and Z. They're in one reality, he's in another. The disaster in the Gulf may well spell the political end of the president and his administration, and that is no cause for joy. It's not good to have a president in this position, weak and polarizing and lacking broad public support, less than halfway through his term. That it is his fault is no comfort. It is not good for the stability of the world or its safety that the leader of the indispensable nation be so weakened. I never until the past 10 years understood the almost moral imperative that an American president maintain the high standing in the eyes of his countrymen. Mr. Obama himself, when running for president, made much of Bush administration distraction and detachment during Katrina. Now the Republican Party will understandably go to town on Mr. Obama's having gone only once to the Gulf, until Friday that is, and the fundraiser in San Francisco seemed to take precedence, and the EPA chief who went to a New York fundraiser in the middle of the disaster. But Republicans should beware and even mute their mischief. We're in the middle of an actual disaster. When they win back the presidency, they'll probably get the big California earthquake, and they'll probably blow it, because ironically enough, of a hard core of truth within their own philosophy, when you ask a government far away in Washington to handle everything, it will handle nothing well. Turning to Wall Street, the S&P 500 fell 8.2% in May as the major averages all slid into negative territory for the year, as well as meeting the threshold on May 20 of a correction, a decline of 10% or more from the highs set a month earlier. The Dow Jones lost 7.9%, its worst May since 1940, and NASDAQ lost 8.3%. Throw in the burgeoning oil disaster, the euro crisis, and increased tensions on the Korean Peninsula, and it was all pretty lousy stuff. One other item on the week, however, the Dow Jones lost 0.6% to 10,136, but the other major averages were up. Volatility, as you are well aware, has been sky high. That's all for this week. Have a great Memorial Day weekend, and I'll be with you next Saturday. For more details, check out the Week in Review column at stocksandnews.com. Take care.